We kick off this hour of the show right away by hopping on board the G&M Family Market phone line and welcoming to the show, well, a man you've seen on countless television shows like The Goldbergs, Deadwood, Californication, the new One Day at a Time, movies like Memento, Sneakers, of course, Groundhog Day. He's been on Broadway. He is an author, a wonderful book, The Dangerous Animals Club. I could do the whole list, but we'd run out of time. Stephen Tobolowsky, thanks for being with us this afternoon.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here, Rich. Pleasure.
Now, I'm hoping, having read your book, that we don't have too many facts, too many frequently asked questions this time around.
Oh, gosh. Those are always the scary ones, the frequently asked ones. Those answers keep changing, even though the questions remain the same.
Now, for anybody who doesn't know, you grew up in Texas. You had a very interesting childhood that comes to life in the book, which is just wonderful, by the way. What was it that led you to becoming a storyteller?
Oh, becoming a storyteller, I think it's because I was good at it, like at an early age. I won the storytelling competition in my school by just telling the story I had read in a book. There was nothing original about it. But they had a contest at our elementary school, and I was in fifth grade, and I told the story of the ghost ship, and it went over big time, and I went to the finals and told it and won first place. So, you know, when you're at a young age, you tend to gravitate toward the things that you do well, thinking maybe that'll pay off along the way. And that's kind of how I started telling stories. But along the way, you amass more horrible things happening in your life, and you find stories come to you naturally.
You were educated at SMU and got through that program as, well, a star of the program, despite being kicked out of the program. Can you explain how that worked?
Well, that's one of those horrible things that happen to you in life. I'm not really sure why it was. I'm assuming it's because I did a striptease for one of my auditions for the faculty, is my guess. But one of the teachers, a new teacher of the school, Joan Potter, took an immediate disliking to me, and she began to work to have me thrown out of the department and then tried to work to keep me from graduating. And it was a battle that took 3 years. And if you think, like, when you go to school, you're 18 years old. And so 3 years was like one-sixth of my life. And it was a battle of wits that went on, and I ended up a temporary victor in that fight, and I ended up graduating, even though she had me thrown out of the department, Rich, but I kept coming to class anyway.
I love
and
that
so
story.
Then they tried to keep me from coming to the classes, and they wouldn't cast me in shows, so I went and got my Equity and SAG card in town, and that made them furious. And then she tried to use a sneaky tactic to get me from graduating, but I ended up taking, I figured she was going to do something, and I took my graduate test a year early. So when she sprung the trap, no one knew I had taken the test but me, and I was able to spring the trap back and say, I'm graduating anyway. So I was lucky, and I ended up graduating first in my class from the drama school, even though I had been thrown out of the drama school.
Now, you've had so many roles through the years, and I understand, especially in working as a character actor, you've got your own sort of hierarchy of roles, and it has to do with the names that those characters are assigned.
Well, yeah, this is what I figured out, and the people you can agree or disagree. This is not a scientific survey, but in kind of scripts, characters that get both names usually are good parts in the script, like Richard Kimball in The Fugitive or Captain Jack Sparrow in Pirates of the Caribbean. When you go to a lower level of actor, you usually get a profession and a name, and it works like this. If you get a profession and a first name, it means you're probably in a comedy. Like, I have played Sheriff Charlie. I have played Ringmaster Bob, Wolfman Jack. I played those parts. When you get a profession and a last name, you're usually in a drama, like Professor Johnson, Detective McLaren. There's a level below this, where you just get kind of what you are, like homeless man, teacher, security guard. And there's a level below this where you get those things but with a number,
ooh,
like security guard 2, homeless man 3. These are really small parts, and I've heard that there are parts even smaller, which are your age and a location, like old man on a train. I mean, these parts are so small that even your mom won't be able to catch you in the show.
When you create the backstory for your character, Stephen, well, what questions do you ask yourself about that character?
That's always tricky, because writers think that they're writing information that an actor can use. Like, they'll say, Stephen Tobolowsky, lawyer, age 40, in my dreams, age 40, and for a woman, they'll say, attractive. And I don't know what any of those words mean, like lawyer, 40. What does that mean? Attractive? Who knows what that means? And so I ask myself the questions like this. Lawyer, am I a good lawyer or a bad lawyer? Am I the first lawyer in my family, or do I come from a long line of lawyers? You find out that being a character actor in particular, a lot of your part is not in the script, and you have to fill it in by using a kind of police work, if you will, detective work, in asking specific questions that could help you in the part. And that's something every actor should do, but every character actor has to do it, because so much of your part is not in the script.
And one of the plays, or one of the movies that you did, The Insider, there was nothing, and Michael Mann was pretty reluctant to share any information with you initially.
Oh, that was terrible. I went, you know, you're doing a movie, you want to do a movie with Michael Mann, fantastic, and they didn't give you a script to audition with. They sent me a page over that said clerk. Okay, we already know from my list of what kind of part it is, this isn't going to be a good part because it's just clerk. At least it's not clerk 2, but it's just clerk. So I read it. I had no idea from the page if I was a hotel clerk, if I was a clerk at a feed store. I had no idea what kind of clerk I was. So consequently, you could learn that part and go in and try to audition, but how could you possibly be good at it? So I went into audition for Michael Mann debating what I was going to do, and I had a while to debate because they kept me waiting for about 2.5 hours. Finally, I went in to see him, and Michael said, well, shall we do this? And I got this sudden bit of inspiration, and I said, no, let's not do this. And he goes, what? I said, let's not do this. Why are we doing this? I said, listen, if I were to ask you to direct a movie, but I'm not going to give you the script, I'm not going to tell you what period of history it's in, what the budget was, or what stars you have, you'd say, well, I can't direct that. Well, I'm saying to you, I can't direct that. I cannot act this or audition for this without reading a script first. So, Michael could have thrown me out. Instead, he laughed, brought me over to his desk, and pulled out a script for The Insider. And I had to sign a 4-page contract that I would not reveal to anyone the contents of this script. And he said, come back tomorrow. So I was able to take the script home, read the entire script. The next day, I read for 4 different parts in the movie. And I knew which every part was because I read the script. And I got one of them, so it was a lucky thing. And as an actor out there, if you have actors out there within the sound of my voice, you have to stand up, if not for yourself, you have to stand up for that little character you're playing. You have to stand up for the right for that little thing that you're trying to bring to life to be able to breathe.
We're talking to Stephen Tobolowsky here on Downtown. Stephen, are you still having what you described as a hero's nightmares?
Oh, God. Now, your audience is so ridiculous. I don't know if your audience would believe this, but I shot that TV show Heroes. You remember the one where the people had the special powers. The first day I'm on that set, I don't know if I could say this on the radio.
Oh, sure you can.
It's okay
to
say things that are a little off color?
Absolutely. We encourage that.
Okay. So anyway, the director came up to me and he said, we have decided that when a character utilizes their special power, they have to exert effort in it. It's a little more than a burp and a little less than going to the potty. You have to have this bit of effort on your face. So I was playing the man who turned things into gold, and we shot the entire second year of that show, and then I get killed. Silo comes and eats my brains out, right? So I'm thinking everything's done with this show, and I get a call several weeks later asking me that they want to reshoot my death because they want to change what it is. But I had a problem now because, now this is the part you're not going to believe. In the interim, between the end of shooting the show and them calling me up again, I broke my neck riding a horse on the side of an active volcano in Iceland. Yes. What could possibly go wrong there? So I'm telling the guys, I said, there's no way I could reshoot the scene. I have a broken neck. And they said, so what, you got a brace on? I said, yes, I have a brace on my neck. And the people from the show said, well, if we took that brace off, what could you do? And I said, well, for one, I could die. So we're not going to do that. He said, no, really. I said, no, listen, if I take the brace off and put on my outfit, I cannot walk. Okay, I'll tell you what I could do. I could sit in a high back chair where the chair supports my head and keeps my head straight, and I can talk, but no one can move me, no one can do anything, and what we do is I have the brace on, you call action, and the camera starts, I take the brace off, you shoot the scene, and then as soon as it's over, I put the brace on and we call cut. So they agreed to that, and they wrote Kristen Bell a new speech for her to say over my dead body. Poor Kristen. She came in, and I'm sitting in the chair with makeup on me. They take the brace off. My head now is only being supported by the back of the chair. Kristen gets on her knees and puts her hand on the arm of the chair, and it makes the chair move, and my head bobbled. And she thought she had just killed me, you know, because there were no bones holding it there. It just went, and she began crying. But God bless her, the pro she is, she kept going through the speech, even though she thought she had killed me. She's crying, and that's the take they used at the end of Heroes Season 2.
I love that story. Man, oh, man. Well, I had a chance, Stephen, the other night to watch the remake of One Day at a Time, like every red-blooded American man in the 70s. I had a crush on Valerie Bertinelli, and I thought, well, how are they going to do this? Norman Lear's 94. What's he thinking? The show is absolutely wonderful.
It's wonderful. Here's where I violated my own rule. They call me in for this audition, and they told me there was no script. So I wasn't able to pull one of those things together that I did with Michael Mann, but it was Norman Lear. And I have another kind of confession to make, is that when I came out to Los Angeles, One Day at a Time was on the air, and a girl from my hometown in Oak Cliff, Texas, Kay Callan, was a guest star on that show. And right when I came out, she said, Stephen, welcome to Los Angeles. Would you like to come see a real TV show being filmed? And so one of the first things I did was see a taping of a real television show, One Day at a Time. Norman Lear was there with his hat on and the works. He introduced the show, and I loved it. I loved the show and the whole process. So in a way, I felt I had this kind of historical connection to the show rather than just the hots for Valerie Bertinelli. Who we all, You know, I was hot for all of them, for Bonnie Franklin, for, you know, Mackenzie Phelps, all of them. But it was, I just trusted Norman Lear. And so they gave me like two or three scenes to audition with, which didn't connect. I didn't know who the people was I was talking to in the audition, but I knew Norman Lear and trusted him. And so I was lucky enough to get the part. And it's one of the great blessings of my life to have been in this show, because I have never been with a cast like this, that everybody is pulling for everyone on this show. And they're such beautiful characters, wonderful writers. It's funny, and in a legitimate way, in an earned way, it can tug at your heart. It can, and not in a manipulative Hollywood saccharine way, but in a very, very real way. It could kind of tear you to pieces by surprise.
Yeah, it's absolutely wonderful. What's also wonderful is your book of The Dangerous Animals Club, and you've got a brand new one that you're working on, Adventures with God, that will be coming out in the springtime.
My Adventures with God. It's coming out April 17th with Simon & Schuster. And after Dangerous Animals Club came out, Simon & Schuster called me into the room to talk with me. I thought they were going to open a bottle of champagne or something like that. They questioned me for like 2.5 hours. And I mean, it's a question like, why did you, you know, the frequently asked questions. I was like going nuts. But in the course of this, I told this story about this meeting I had one morning at dawn with this rabbi, and everyone in the room was kind of weepy at the end of the story. So after Dangerous Animals Club came out, my editor called me up and said, Stephen, Simon & Schuster wants you to do another book of stories, but can you include the story about the rabbi? So I did another series of true stories, fun stories, My Adventures with God, based on the premise that all of our lives, everybody pretty much follows the template of the Old Testament, at least to my way of thinking. First of all, we all have our genesis of where we came from, our family. Everything we talk about on a first date over a first glass of Chardonnay, that's usually our genesis. Then we all go into slavery, except instead of building pyramids, a lot of us end up in graduate school forever, or get hooked by drugs and alcohol, or first loves, first jobs. We get out of slavery and find we're still lost in the desert. And then we have this moment in the middle of our lives that I call the Leviticus moment, kind of where we say, this is what I am. And in my book, I have stories about when I got married and when I first had kids and the story with the rabbi. And then death comes into our lives, like in the book of Numbers, and we're reshaped by mortality, losing family, friends, and then finally, in Deuteronomy, we tell the stories of our life to other people, like Moses did to the children of Israel, to remind them what they were doing, because they had probably forgotten in the 39 years they were walking in the wilderness. So that's kind of what the template of My Adventures with God, and it's a lot like Dangerous Animals Club, kind of fun stories, a few showbiz stories, some not-so-fun stories. But all true stories, and I really love it. That's me. You know, I wrote it, so I have to love it.
Well, yeah. Do you find it more satisfying to create your own stories through your writing, or to create characters where someone else has written the script, but you make them your own?
Boy, right now in my life, if you ask me that question today, I love writing. I love writing probably more than anything I've loved in my life, because I feel I can do anything. I feel empowered. You know, when you start to tell a story, a lot of the power of the story is not just what you tell in the story, but making the choice of what you don't tell. And that creates all sorts of patterns of light and shadow that you can play with and create humor and create tragedy and all sorts of things. And it's that kind of freedom that I really love right now. Now maybe it's because it's new to me and I'm having fun doing it, And also, I should mention, it's writing the stories that's fun. Like, I don't think I'd have the same fun writing a screenplay. That would be torture. And I wouldn't have fun with another type of writing. But this kind of creating stories and writing stories is really kind of where I'm at and where I'm living.
Are you still grateful for Ned Ryerson, or do you get tired of the recognition from that?
Oh, I love Ned Ryerson. Ned Ryerson has been very good to me in a very kind way. You know, he's a kind guy. He's a funny guy. He's a wacky guy, the guy doing Groundhog Day. And I just went back to Dallas to visit my family, my father, and went out to eat with my brother. And at lunch, at dinner, people came up to me and go, "Bing, does anyone ever say that to you? Or watch out for that first step, it's a doozy." And I said, just about every day they say that to me. And I love it because Ned has brought so much joy to people's lives. So they give it back to me when they say, "Thank you for being in that movie." And it's a wonderful, wonderful feeling.
Also, thank you for your scholarly analysis of Nicki Minaj's Anaconda that I watched over the weekend. That was remarkable.
I got to tell you, that one was pulled out of thin air. I'm flying to Seattle, and they tell me they want me to do a dance, like a dance, and they have me work an entire day with a choreographer to do a dance to Nicki Minaj's Anaconda. And I'm thinking, like, guys, is this in the best of taste? I mean, we have this, like, 60-something-year-old man, like, shaking his head. I just don't know if this will be in bad taste. And I get a phone call the night before the shoot, and they say, "You know, you're right. This kind of stinks. Maybe we shouldn't do this. You have any other ideas of what you could do?" And I said, "I don't know, but we better come up with it quick. Let me just do an analysis of Nicki Minaj's Anaconda." So I went on the internet, thank God for internet and hotels, and I looked up all sorts of stuff on it, and I do a scholarly interpretation of Nicki Minaj's Anaconda. And I do believe they stuck in a couple moments of me dancing in there, I think.
Just enough.
I believe.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, Stephen, I love One Day at a Time. If you haven't checked it out, it's on Netflix. It's absolutely terrific. I really enjoyed the book and look forward to the new one in the spring. And it's been a blast for us to talk with you this afternoon. Thank you for making time for us.
You got it, Rich. Thank you so much.
That is Stephen Tobolowsky joining us here on Downtown.